Right, Cabinet today approved the minimum wage order, which has gone to Executive Council, bringing into effect the new $12 an hour minimum adult rate, $480 a week from the 1st of April, which I'm sure will be greatly appreciated by those on the bottom rung of the wage ladder. We've also approved the revised version of the Cabinet manual. From time to time, the Cabinet Office undertakes a major overhaul of the Cabinet manual to bring it up to date with changes which have been made. The last update was in 2001, so this one incorporates references to the Crown Entities legislation, which was passed in 2004, and also the State Services Code of Conduct, plus guidance which has been issued from time to time over the last 7 years on Cabinet circulars and through minutes. So that will be available in a final version in the not-too-distant future. For those who are late, I'm just referring to the revised version of the Cabinet manual, which is due to be published shortly. Discussion papers to be issued. There will be one coming out from the food safety people on fees and charges which are levied under the Agricultural Compounds and Veterinary Medicines Act. Another discussion paper from Building and Housing, which is an evaluation of the 1987 legislation on the Fencing of Swimming Pools Act. There's also an announcement Leanne Dalziel will make this week around a review of the science associated with the A1, A2 milk issue. We've agreed to establish a Family Violence Death Review Committee under the New Zealand Public Health and Disability Act. This was a recommendation of the Task Force for Action on Violence in the Family. And we've also made decisions about the rate of interest which will prevail on the student loan scheme for 07-08. Peter Dunn will no doubt issue a statement on the rate. That is, of course, for those who pay it. If you stay in New Zealand, you don't pay interest on your student loan. Again, for those who are late, I should say, I started with a reference to the minimum wage order, which went through Cabinet and Executive Council today, which brings into effect the $12 an hour rate for adults for $480 a week. Coming up in the House this week, there's 2 days of government business. Tomorrow there's 1 hour and 5 minutes remaining on my Prime Minister's statement, the debate around that, and then we move to a number of first readings this week. We have down for first reading a biosecurity and hazardous substances and new organisms legislation amendment in Jim Anderton's name. First reading of Leanne Dalziel's financial advisers bill. First reading of Annette King's policing bill, which is the big rewrite of the police legislation. First reading of the corrections amendment bill, Phil Goff's name. First reading of the summary offences, tagging and graffiti vandalism amendment, and also a first reading of the Alcohol Advisory Council amendment bill. It is also a Members' Day, Private Members' Day, Local Bills Day this week. Otherwise, coming up, Phil Goff has opened the conference, International Conference on Cluster Munitions, which is being held in Wellington this week, a major international conference to try and work towards a convention which will tighten the rules on the types of cluster munition which can be used and in which circumstances, particularly aimed at the protection of civilians. Otherwise, coming up this week, we have the International Rugby Board in town. There'll be meetings with them, a brief one involving me also tomorrow morning. Phil Goff will be issuing tomorrow a statement on progress on the joint study into the New Zealand-Korea free trade agreement. Come Wednesday, Trevor Mallard will release new research around New Zealand's attitudes to care for the environment. 5 o'clock on Wednesday will be the valedictory speech from Anne Hartley. Anne Hartley has been a Member of Parliament since 1999 and is now retiring. She was elected to North Shore City Council last October, and she'll be moving on to do that on a full-time basis. Otherwise, this week, Thursday, there will be a release of the Major Jobs for Youth report done on New Zealand by the OECD. I have referred to this in speeches I've made around the raising of the leaving age from education, and I think you'll find that the recommendations in the report are very consistent with the path that we've taken on that in endeavouring to get people to stay at school longer and also boost the level of achievement in education and to boost opportunities for apprenticeship and skills training for young people. So that's pretty much what's coming up this week. I should also signal that the provincial governor of Barmian Province, where the New Zealand provincial reconstruction team is, will be arriving in New Zealand for a visit next weekend and into next week. I believe I have a meeting scheduled with her probably at some point that week or the following one. And later today I'll be meeting with the Vanua 2 p.m. and we will have a stand-up at the end of that meeting for anyone who's interested. Any questions?
Did you suggest to Ivan Ben that he may have to keep that report?
Not to the best of my knowledge.
What do you think it is that he told his paper?
Well, I think you should look at his own press statement on that matter, where he makes it clear that he was not offered a position in the Cabinet.
When you say not the best in my knowledge, do you mean that there may have been some conversation that's been misinterpreted?
Well, I've no idea. What I know is the first time I registered the name of Owen Glenn was when he approached me at a New Zealand tourism event in Sydney after I had paraded in a wearable arts award costume dressed as a power. And as I passed Mr. Glenn, he handed out his card to me and said that he would be interested in giving the Labour Party some support. I passed his name on to Mr. Williams, promptly forgot Mr. Glenn's name, so that when Mr. Williams rang me back and asked who it was I'd referred him to, I couldn't remember, and he had to go back and search through his cards himself. So that's my first conscious awareness that there was a person called Owen Glenn. And apart from that, I clearly recall a dinner in 2006 when the University of Auckland held a dinner to publicise and thank him for the $7.5 million contribution to the business school. And I believe we were seated at the same table. Now, you know, I can't rule out that Mr. Glenn might have been one of dozens of people among hundreds of people attending a Millennium Regatta after-match function at Carwell Island that I was at 5 years ago, but I've no recollection of.
Do you think they might have been light-heartedly joking about it?
It would have to have been pretty light-hearted.
Were you dressed as a power, I'm wondering?
Not at the Regatta, no. Not even as a sailor.
Do you think that, in hindsight, perhaps Mike Williams or Labour should have declared the $100,000 interest-free loan that Owen Glenn went on to offer and was accepted by Mike?
Well, you'd have to put that to Mike Williams and to the advice the party took. The party does publish audited accounts. I understand it was referred to in those accounts. I understand the advice they had was that because the foregone interest was less than the amount required to declare that they didn't declare in accordance with their understanding of the law.
But you've made quite a point of your distaste for anonymous donations. And don't you think that having that fundraising helped you pay back that the money in the
Well, in my own view, transparency is always best, and that's why the law now is much more transparent. But let's be clear, the only reason Owen Glenn's name is in the public arena at all is because he chose to openly put his name to a donation to the New Zealand Labour Party. There's $3 million spent by the National Party for the last campaign where nobody knows where it came from because it went through secret trusts, not an open donation of the kind Mr. Glenn made. And furthermore, we read in media reporting that prior to the end of last year, the National Party was scurrying around all its anonymous donors again to to try and get money into the kitty before the new rules kicked into force on the 1st of January. So I hope that there might be a little investigation into those secret donations.
Did that $500,000 in donations and the $100,000 interest fee loan have any bearing at all on them receiving a new year's honour?
Of course not. The reason for him receiving an honour relates to the extraordinary generosity to the University of Auckland, and also the fact that he would be one of the most successful business people to have come out of New Zealand and done well on the world stage.
His statement that came out of the public relations firm, did you guys first know about that in your office, and did you have a hand in this?
I first knew about it when I came back from Cabinet and the Cabinet lunch and saw it when I sat down to think about the press conference somewhere around 2:30.
Are you still going to open the business school by Thursday?
I'm sure the plaque's been engraved, so it will be unveiled.
What are you going to say to him, Mr. Glenn?
Hello?
Is there a perception problem with the honour, and just in the sense that Cabinet does stamp these things off, suggested by Cabinet, someone would have said, hang on, this is Labor's biggest donor in the last election campaign. Is this going to look bad?
So it has to stack up in spite of that. And for once, I agree with the Herald editorial on the subject, which made the point that the fact that someone has donated to a political party should not be a barrier to having other generosity and achievements recognised in the honours list.
Was that all of the reason, perhaps, that the $100,000
as I've said to you, I always think transparency is best in these matters, and I'm pleased that the new law is more transparent.
When was that loan effective? Was it last year or the year before?
You'd have to go to Mike Williams, because I personally, as I'm sure all party leaders do, maintain a very great distance from party fundraising and when and where what is paid, lent, etc.
Probably 6 months financial statements. Are there any warnings for you in the operating surplus being down across forecasts? And is this going to place any pressure on tax cut packages or consideration?
Well, my understanding is that the accounts are affected by returns for government investments like the New Zealand Superannuation Fund, which when there's volatility in world markets aren't going to give you the sort of return that they did before. But we're known for being a prudent government. I'm sure it'll be a prudent budget.
In the past, though, you've always had a bit of a tax windfall, which has given you, I think, $500 million or so. Looking at those figures, it doesn't appear that'll be the case this year. Is that a concern?
Well, it would be the exception, wouldn't it? Because for years, tax forecasts have run well ahead. Well, the tax returns have run well ahead of what the Treasury forecast. This year, preliminary evidence is it's running a little bit the other way around. But as I said in my statement last week, the international global market volatility shows the value of the government having pursued a strong fiscal and economic management policy, and I don't think the Crown accounts are due for a cause for undue concern given the strength of the policy we've followed for a lot of years.
But will the court be in political difficulty in the sense that in the past Dr. Cullen has argued that tax cuts weren't affordable, and the books do perhaps look, while still in a healthy shape, not as healthy as they've been in the past, are you going to proceed with tax cuts?
Well, the books are in a strong state, and the budget will reveal how all these issues are dealt with.
Do you have any more information on the medals that were returned and whether the reward money went to maybe the people that were responsible for the crime in the first place?
No, I don't have any more information than has been in the public arena. I recall when Lord Ashcroft first came forward with the offer, saying to at least some media that one of the dangers with rewards is you might set up expectations that those who steal will end up getting paid for returning what they've stolen. That is a problem with rewards. Now, the police, having weighed it all up, made their own decision to offer a reward. And I think from the point of view of most Kiwis, they'll be absolutely thrilled to see all those medals back. They'd get a double thrill if the police were now in a position to arrest the people who did it.
Doesn't it look dangerously like they're paying a ransom?
Well, as I said, if you offer a reward, there's always the possibility that those who stole things are going to be the ones who end up claiming it. That's inherent in offering a reward, and the police don't very often offer a reward.
But presumably here in some way we've handed this money over without knowing where it's going. Normally a reward goes to someone who is worthy of it. So we need to come forward and say, you know, I've found whatever you've lost.
I doubt that that's true in cases of this kind. In this case, the money went to the lawyer who was the intermediary.
Do you think the lawyer has acted entirely honorably?
I don't really have a comment on that. I assume he has worked with the police to secure the return of the medals. But beyond that, I really can't comment.
Well, he can see that the service lawyer managed to find the people responsible, he says, within about 3 days. The police still haven't got any, haven't made any arrests.
Well, the police have very extensive contacts in the underworld. That's one of the tools of fighting crime. Who knows how this particular case was actually conducted. They may have felt that given this former police officer had made that much progress, they would see what came through that channel. But really, I think they have to say what they're prepared to say about this in the end. And they are still pursuing leads which they would hope would lead to arrest.
In our latest Cromwell Runton poll, we asked voters for a moment, forget, if you like, who they actually support as Prime Minister, and to say who they believed would actually win the election. And around 52% said John Key, and 26% of Labour voters even tipped it to be John Key. Does that concern you? Does it give you a sense that there's so much momentum behind him now that he can face the sequel to the election?
No, that doesn't concern me. I think it's inevitable when you've had a period of polling leads that there will be an answer to a question like that that will reflect what those polls have been saying. But it simply redoubles my determination to get on and make a good fight of it.
What about New Zealand's position on Kosovo declaring independence from Serbia, especially given the difficulties within the Security Council and the EU and NATO?
Well, we're disappointed that what was called the Troika process didn't get results. There was a three-way process between the United States, Russia and the European Union to try and work out an agreed position on Kosovo's status, and that fell over in December. So the possibility of Kosovo unilaterally declaring independence has been there for a couple of months now. With respect to New Zealand's position, it's never been the New Zealand government's position to recognise in such circumstances. We will neither recognise nor not recognise over time. The way in which we deal with those who govern in the territory will, I suppose, imply whether there is recognition, but we are not intending to make a formal statement. This is quite a divisive issue internationally, obviously, and it's not clear to me that all EU states will want to recognise.
What about the response from Serbia? Are you concerned that tensions might flare up, might be more violence in that region, given the history? You think you see the response from Serbia is so
for sure there's a troubled history. But then Serbia has just had elections, and the candidate described as the more moderate of the two, the incumbent president, was re-elected. So we would certainly hope that that would be reflected in a more sober reaction to what's happened in Kosovo.
It certainly remains a volatile situation.
Oh, for sure, because Serbia would say that they regard Kosovo as being at the heart of traditional Serbia. It happens to have a large majority Albanian population. It would be tremendously distressing if there was now an outbreak of, in effect, civil war there, which would see persecution and death of those in the minority.
Have you any requests that
No, I'm not expecting that from the Governor of Barmian. I think she's coming to, in effect, thank New Zealand for the substantial help that's gone into her province from us over a period of a good 4.5 years now. But I wouldn't be expecting any further request of a military kind coming from the Governor. I'm sure development assistance is always welcome, but we do make a commitment there.
I don't think there's been a request from NATO or
from... Well, I'm struggling to recall anything specific. I think the full answer is that more is always welcome, but we are reasonably fully stretched with our small force at the moment, not least with the Timor commitment being ongoing and with the Solomon's commitment being ongoing.
Have you had any update today on the drought and the level of the hydro lakes?
Yes, on both. We have had a drought report from Jim Anderton. Certainly the rain has been greatly appreciated in Canterbury, where it's fallen and has moved some of the area there out of the most critical category. But there's still very, very dry conditions in a lot of New Zealand. I drove down State Highway 2 myself through the area to the east of Pokeno at the weekend, through down the Thames and Ngātia area, and it really looked like Canterbury in the middle of the drought, not something we're accustomed to seeing in the Waikato. So that's still quite serious. I think there is rain during the Waikato today, but then some again. So it's quite difficult for the Waikato dairy farmers, let alone still sheep and beef farmers in a lot of areas. And with sheep and beef prices not having been anything like as attractive as dairy prices, farmer morale can start to drop. That's been the reason behind the drought summit and the close coordination between the government, the farm leaders, the banks, the rural trusts and so on. I haven't received the report yet, no. But Mrs. King may get something more this week, but from what she said this morning, I think that the authorities would like to take a little time to do it properly before they make their full recommendations to us.
Sorry, what was the... you said you also had an update on the hydro leaks? Mm.
It's true that inflows are quite low, as you'd expect from where you've seen the pattern of rain falling, but to what extent that will be affected by the rain we've seen in the past week and in the present time, hard to say.
The Maori House of the Woman put out a statement calling on changes to the way Parliament operates to offer better work-life balance to MPs, particularly in light of Catherine Richards' decision for announcement last week that she was going to retire from politics. Do you see any prospect or room for improvement in the way this place operates?
Well, when I compare it with my first term here between 81 and 84, when all-night sittings for day after day were common, so people didn't get any sleep except what they could snatch lying on a sofa in the lobby, it's immensely better. It used to be that when Parliament finally got round to having a solid session for the budget around July, that it would just sit continuously for the rest of the year, no breaks at all. School holidays were immaterial to the routine of Parliament. Now, going back to the reforms Geoffrey Palmer brought in when he was Leader of the House, there's been a lot more consideration of family-life balance. And certainly when we design the parliamentary timetable now, we look to see when the school holidays are so that we try to time recesses around that to give people more time to be in their constituencies. It is true that these jobs are hard jobs if you do them properly. And I think everyone needs to take on board the need to get enough sleep and not to burn the candle too much at both ends. There's times when that becomes almost inevitable, like election campaigns. But in a sense, our destiny is in our own hands as to how we schedule and organise our work.
The Maori Party raised the prospect for an apology in the way for the Australian apology outside of private settlement.
Well, firstly, I think the Australian apology is a very, very important one. It's a new chapter in Australian history and a welcome one. It is a reasonably narrowly focused apology around the stolen generations. Now, New Zealand has had a reconciliation process running for quite a long time, and indeed the course of the 20th century, I think, generally has a lot more reconciliation in it for New Zealand than Australia's ever seen. Now, the course taken here has been to move to settle iwi by iwi, sometimes hapu by hapu, and almost invariably the settlement involves an apology, which is specific. And I think that's been valued. I don't hear widespread calls for a different approach to be taken. I think iwi and hapu value the apology which comes specific to their circumstances of having suffered a wrong.
Do you think that the Australian reconciliation will eventually move towards compensation?
Well, I think Australia's taken a step which opens up the prospect of other steps being called for, and that's a journey they're going to have to travel for themselves. As we know with New Zealand experience, for many, many decades, Māori called for the treaty to be honoured, and that fell on deaf ears. Norman Kirk's government opened up the prospect of some reconciliation through the establishment of the Waitangi Tribunal, but it didn't have a mandate to go retrospective. But having opened that door, then quite legitimately pressure came for the next steps. And the next steps were for David Longie's government to open the door to treaty claims to be made back to 1840. So we've been on a long journey on this ourselves. And as I say, I think something has started in Australia that's very significant. One doesn't know where it might end.
Prime Minister, are you aware of the International Bar Association for the Bar from Fiji, that delegation that went to go there today? Mm. They've been stopped from going there to look at human rights. Is that concerning to you?
Oh, certainly. And it suggests to me that the Fiji interim government is extremely sensitive around its poor performance on human rights. The International Bar Association very much stand for upholding the rule of law and constitutions and people's individual rights and liberties. So I think we can read quite a lot into the refusal to have them visit Fiji.
Would you be talking about Fiji?
Oh, for sure. That will be covered as a regional issue.
Is there any concern about East Timor still? Or are we still considering, or still have any troops on standby to go there?
In terms of being on standby, we have a platoon generally on standby. It's not specific to Timor, but we do have a platoon that's generally ready to move at short notice at Burnham. Not expecting that to be called on for Timor at this time. All things considered, given the seriousness of the assassination attempts, things have remained relatively calm. I did speak to the East Timor Prime Minister Shinana Gusmao last week, and he seemed very calm about the situation and was really thinking about how to move it forward. He didn't convey to me the impression that he was had a deep level of concern about security at the present time.
Thank you.